Could we start? It's about 9 o'clock. I guess I'm on the thing. Do we normally leave the one door open? Good, it's fine with me. Okay. Alright, well, this I guess I should be, for the recording's sake, you can all hear me, right? I don't need a microphone. Good. For the recording's sake, this is, it's Saturday, January the 21st, and this is Los Angeles. And, my name is Laurie. I'm a compulsive overeater. I'm your presenter for today. I want to thank you all for coming here, and actually thank the organizers for, allowing me to come here. Maybe we could just begin with a serenity prayer, if we could. Just have a moment of silence for those who still suffer, both inside and outside of the program. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom to know the difference. I will not mind be done. Well, thank you all for coming. I'm going to be talking, and just as a warning, there's not sharing, I'm going to be talking. I'm going to be giving a big book workshop and analyze and talk about the big book and talk about it as if it contained, because I do believe it contains, directions for doing the steps. It was written by Christian, white, patronizing, chauvinistic, gutter drunks, male, gutter drunks who had a grounding in biblical literature from the 1890s. So it is not necessarily accessible to a lot of people, and yet it is an inspired book. A lot of people who are religious, you'll soon find that I am absolutely not religious. I don't have any kind of God in the normal sense, and I will be talking about it in step two. A lot of people believe it's inspired by their God, and I have no reason to disbelieve that. From my point of view, it is at least inspired as a work of art, as any great work of art is, in that every sentence contains the whole. It was written in a holistic way, and I hope to be able to show you the consistency and the brilliance of how this book is constructed. It has its flaws. The chapter to the wives is it has some good information in it, but boy, it's hard to read. And you know it purports to be written by wives, but in fact it was written by Bill Wilson, who Lois, Bill's wife and the co-founder of Al-Anon, complained, was furious with him, you know, and Bill said, oh, well, I need it for consistency, you know, consistency of language. Yet he allowed Hank P. to write the chapter to the employers, having edited it quite a bit. I am purely OA. I've never been in any other 12-step program, as you'll hear. I can't even drink more than a drink and a half of wine before I really don't like it, as good as it may taste. And so I'm giving it to you from purely OA. I owe a great deal of what I'm about to say to Joe and Charlie, whom I'm sure many of you have heard of, or either heard or heard of, two Joes, one Charlie. One Joe retired, and Charlie got another Joe. And they absolutely changed my life, and without their analysis of the big book, I don't think I would have come out of a relapse. I've been abstinent for, it'll be 19 years, approximately May of this year. Been a member of the program almost my anniversary, February the 11th of 1986. I normally give big book studies that are about twice as long as what I'm about to give today. So my options are either to speak twice as quickly or to omit some of the stuff. I'm going to be omitting. I'm not going to be talking about the book. I'm not going to be reading from the book in as much detail as I normally do. I am sadly going to miss some of the history. I find the history both inspiring and instructive. I'm going to leave out some of the history because I just don't have time. For those of you who love to read Dr. Jung's letter, I probably will not have time to read and analyze Dr. Jung's letter. I won't have time to tell you about Roland and all that. But so be it. This is going to be an intensive analysis. I also invite you, if you want, I'm happy to talk to anyone at breaks, and I'm happy as well to tell you that there is a web page which contains a lot of the information which I'm going to be giving you and more. Which has all kinds of downloads that you can have, and it's OA Big Book, all one word, OA Big Book, dot info, I-N-F-O, not net, not com, not org, but info, because it's just an information page. And on that, you can download a book, which has quotes in the book which will buttress what I'm going to be telling you. So I can't, normally in the longer Big Book study, I will sort of read the book and show you where I get the interpretation from. I can't today. But I also tell you, as Joe and Charlie tell you, if you read anything in the Big Book that's contrary to what I say, believe the Big Book. I believe it is an inspired book, and I hope to be able to show you that. A few business things just to get over with. For the benefit of those who are listening on the tape who aren't here, I want to describe the room. We're in a windowless room. A cave. I have no idea what color these walls are. Taupe. Oh, God. I love that word. I'll never remember what that... Taupe. Okay. People are arranged in the theater style. We'll be breaking sometime, by the way.
Brown
and light brown, yeah. There are a lot of people seated in front of me in the theater style, about 500. I'm dressed in what color is this shirt? Blue?
Blue.
Oh, good. Okay. The sweater. I'm dressed in a sweater and taupe pants. Oh, but I don't match the taupe wall. But I guess they're taupe as well. Okay. All right. The fact that the people here can see, but which can't be seen on the tape, is a curse that I've lived with all my life. I look like Robert Redford, the young Robert Redford, it's difficult to look like a god, but I do. I've done a lot of step fours on that one. I want to read to you the first policy ever presented by OA. It's from OA's first business conference. It has never been never been amended or changed. And it stands as the proposition with which I want to begin today. It's not well written. It really isn't well written. We endorse as our only basic creed, the only thing that OA in general subscribes to from headquarters, the 12 steps and the 12 traditions. That this is the only basic program that OA headquarters believes as its creed. We acknowledge that these two things are the only creed that OA subscribes to, basically. Now, it's never been amended. I don't think it has quite the hallowed significance of the Big Book, which has never been amended either. But the point of it is that the 12 steps are the basic part of our program. Not the tools, not love, not enabling, not, you know, keep coming back. It's the 12 steps. And as a program, we stand for a simple proposition, Tradition 5. The primary purpose of every OA group is to carry the message of water, recovery through the 12 steps, to those who still suffer. I'm not sure OA does a great job of that, generally, although I'm humbled by being in California, you know, the birthplace where there are people with, you know, in my hometown of Winnipeg, Canada, I am an old-timer. I'm a sort of a senior citizen with almost 19 years of abstinence. That's a tragedy. But I was so wonderful at the count up last night to see people with much longer term recovery. I feel like a piker in front of them. I also don't have the same compelling story that a lot of people have. I didn't bring my pictures. I thought I had, but I didn't. You'll see that I was really quite fat, but I was never morbidly obese. I was lucky to get into this program early. I haven't suffered much. At the first OA meeting I used to go to a meeting that was, you could call it a soap opera meeting. It was sort of like you come week after week to find out what happened. You know, full of recovery, but people say, oh, did he break up with his wife? Did she talk back to the foreman? You know, and things of that sort. A lot of recovery there, but it was full of people who had really suffered. And in our program, a lot of people have suffered. We've been victims of so many things. How many women, especially in this program, have been abused and become fat as a result of that abuse to protect themselves, or vice versa, have been abused because they're fat. And for women especially, it's been eating has been a tremendous sometimes a relief from abuse and sometimes a creator of abuse. The sad stories that I have heard in this program have they haven't broken my heart because so many of them have come up with triumph. They've ended up in triumph and the overcoming of that. But they have been very deep. And I've led a pretty ordinary and privileged life. It's lucky for me. And I remember at my first OA meeting that I took about 3 months after I joined, where I said, I'm sorry, I haven't suffered as you have. You know, here's my story, but I know it's not a dramatic story. And as the sharing went around the room, a long, long timer in OA and AA said, you know, Laurie, from those of us who have been in the gutter, you haven't missed a thing. And I thought, well, okay, fine, because what brings us together is not whether we suffered. What brings us together, whether we suffered humiliation, abuse, physical or emotional or mental damage, what brings us together is that we have a problem, an addiction of a certain kind. I hope to be able to talk about that and to analyze it from the perspective of the big book. I do want to say, although I am a big book thumper, and I know trivial things about the big book that most of us big book thumpers do, and I'll point out the shortest sentence in the big book to you and, you know, and all that, and I even know where the typos are. I am not one of those who says, if you don't do it the way the first 100 did it, then you don't have what the first 100 did. Well, first of all, the first 100 did it very differently depending on whether they lived in New York or Akron or Cleveland. If you look at the history of AA, you'll see a whole bunch of back to basics, and the history of in OA slightly, a whole bunch of back to basics where people are trying to bring back to the basics. Well, it depends on whether they follow Dr. Bob or they follow the big book. I don't even know how Bill, we never know how Bill sponsored, but we do know what Bill wrote. So there are many different ways of doing it, and there are many ways of doing it in OA that give some people recovery. And I have good friends. I'm humble in relation to those friends who have been abstinent and are more spiritual and longer than I have been and are more spiritual than I, who don't use the big book as a set of directions. As far as I'm concerned, the big book provides a great set of directions that allows you to do the steps quickly and powerfully. And that's good. And if your steps aren't working for you, then you should be thinking about working different steps in a different way. And the big book provides that with you. I have experienced the ability to be around foods that used to beckon to me and consider them to be rat poison. I've experienced that freedom from the bondage of food that the big book promises. I've had that for over 18 years. That's a miracle for me. It ain't a miracle for my wife. It's not a miracle for most normal people for me to be able to say that ice cream goes bad in my freezer and I don't care. It's not a miracle for anyone I know other than an OA for me to say that I can go to a fancy restaurant with my wife and she can order a dessert. She's a chocoholic, but she only eats one a day. To have her, you know, order a deep, dark, delicious, you know, cheese, a chocolate thing, and she bites into it, and she says, oh, which sometimes makes me very jealous. And it's a miracle for me not to want to try it. That's a miracle for me. It's a miracle for me that when she stops eating it halfway through and says, I'm full, I'll save the rest of it for tomorrow. It's a miracle for me that I don't want to try it then, or I don't want to say, you know, and the third miracle is I'm not angry at her for not finishing it. How can you not eat something you love? Which I used to say. Now, that's a miracle for me. And if it's a miracle for you, then maybe this program is for you, too. I want to read off to you 12 provocations. The first time I ever read these off, I was at a retreat in Maine, and a woman came up to me on the Sunday morning and said, if I hadn't paid for the whole weekend, I would have left after you read them, because she was so upset by them. I do answer them, and I hope to answer them by Sunday morning, about 10 to 11, before I finish. But I'm going to read them off to you. And I'm not sure whether to some of you any of these are provocations, but I know that somewhere in OA, one, two, or all of them are tremendously contentious. And so I'm going to read them off to you, and let's see how many people feel as if as if I'm pushing nerves here. I'm a recovered compulsive eater, not a recovering one. Bother anyone? Good. Abstinence is not the most important thing in my life without exception. Bother anyone? Does it? Okay, it does, yes. Although a sponsor, if available, is very important for recovery, a sponsor is not necessary for recovery. That bothers a lot of people. I believe all of these are found in the Big Book. Four, you can recover in weeks. Intrigue anyone, I hope. Five, the tools of recovery are not an essential part of the OA program. Yes. Six, you don't take steps one and two. Seven, these are found in the book that you can download on oabigbook.info. And they are answered. I mean, you know, I'm saying this just to pique your interest, not to make you so mad that you leave. But if you want to leave, you can leave. You can put me on your resentment list. Seven, steps 3, 6, 7, and 8 should not take a long time to get through. They're short steps. Eight, you don't make amends to yourself. Nine, you should not sponsor until after you've completed step 9. Now, just to explain, sponsoring means carrying the message. You cannot carry that which you do not have, according to Big Book. 10, this is, I learned this for after.
I don't think you finished
reading all of 9. 9 is, you should not sponsor until after you've completed step 9. 10, this is my own experience, service is not slimming. 11, and I don't know if this applies to any of the meetings you go to, but it sure applies somewhere in OA. Food can be discussed at meetings. Are there meetings where you can't talk about food?
Oh, yeah.
Yes. Yeah, it amazes me. Pardon me?
God forbid.
God forbid, yeah. And 12, I have not yet written to the best. I can read it both. I can formulate it in a couple of different ways. I'll formulate it in the nicest way I know how, which is some people who come to meetings should consider the responsibility they owe to the meetings in declaring that they themselves have a desire to stop eating compulsively. And put it in the not nicest way. So, do you want me to repeat that? I can't. Some people who come to OA meetings should consider the responsibility they owe to those meetings and consider whether or not they really do have a desire to stop eating compulsively. Okay? Or put in another, yes. Of my 12th part, some people who come to OA meetings have a responsibility to that meeting to consider what it really means to have a desire to stop eating compulsively. In other words, they have a responsibility to think whether they really are members of OA, whether they really have that desire, or whether they're using us as a support group. Put another way, I heard it said that in OA they say that the open door also swings out. And I think you'll find that the Big Book stands for the proposition that we should not spend a great deal of time with someone who has no interest in performing the steps. So I'll talk about that a lot more tomorrow. So, as Mort Saul used to say at the end of his talk, that's it. Well, they're all in the book. They're all in that book, at OA Big Book. And I can show you, I mean, this is the book here. It's a book that's available at oabigbook.info. And I'll go back to them on Sunday morning when I'll answer them if they haven't already been answered. So these are to pique your interest. They're not necessarily designed to offend you, but as Mort Saul used to say at the end of the set, is there anyone else here I haven't offended? We're going to be studying the Big Book. Yes. Okay. Yes. I haven't offended you. I'm glad to know that. Okay. Although I appreciate interruptions for clarification, it's going to be very hard because of the taping to sort of deal with questions or anything of that sort. So, we're going to begin studying the book by looking at the title page. And if you have the Big Book in front of you, terrific. Alcoholics Anonymous, the story of how many thousands of men and women have recovered from compulsive eating. Not are recovering. Even though this book was published only 4 years into the program, 1935 is the date of the beginning of AA, after actually 3.5 years or 4 years, they were able to say with certainty that they had recovered. They were not cured, but they had recovered. They recovered from an illness of the mind and body, as we'll find. In the preface, which is on XI, forward to the first edition, which is found on XIII of the Big Book, it says, We of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. They don't mince words. They aren't nice. They don't say, oh, we're recovering. They say, we have recovered. And the use of, if you look at a word index of the big book, you'll find that the word recovered is used 11 or 12 times to describe the state of people who have worked the steps. And the word recovering is used only once, actually in the chapter to the wives, to describe a person who has not yet finished the steps, has not yet worked the steps. The message we have to give, if there is any message, the message of recovery, is that when you work the steps, you will no longer want to go back. You will have the freedom. And if we don't provide that message with some certainty to those who still suffer, what hope is there for them? I'll talk a lot more about that in step when I talk about step 12 tomorrow. I hope to cover steps 1, 2, and 3 this morning and this afternoon, steps 4 through 9. I may touch on 10, and then Sunday morning, steps 11, 10 a bit, and 11 and 12. 12 in the greatest detail. I think that's the area where OA really needs to talk about what its message is. I want to tell my story, and in telling my story, I want to talk about the book's concepts. Here are my eating stories. One is the generic story. One is the story that covers 99% of my eating history. The hand. It might be holding a fork. It might be holding a spoon. More often, it's holding itself. It's bare. And the food is coming from the hand into the mouth. And the hand is bringing it to the mouth, and the mind is saying, I've got to stop. This is crazy. I have to stop. I'm gaining weight. And the hand just keeps bringing it to the mouth inexorably, just constantly. And the mind can't say, my mind can't say, stop it. It's always, well, the next, I'm stopping it the next time, and it doesn't stop it. That's my generic story. And that happened to me all the time. I have eaten tubs of ice cream. I have eaten entire chickens. I have, whether small or big, whole cakes. I mean, it's nothing to me to eat. It has been nothing to me to eat all those things. I'll tell you two more stories, though, because these are stories that illustrate the depths to which I went. Some of you know of the holiday of Hanukkah. I'm Jewish. Hanukkah is a festival of lights and grease. Well, it's true. It commemorates the fact that a miracle occurred when a cask of olive oil was discovered to keep the eternal flame, to relight the eternal flame. It could only last a day, but in fact, a miracle happened. It lasted for eight days. So the oil that was used is sort of, it's both light and fat. And the traditional, one of the traditional dishes for Hanukkah, at least among Eastern Europeans, is goose, the fattest domesticated bird around. And my mother cooked a goose, and it was very good. And then there were the potato pancakes, which are deep fried, and then there's the called blinis, which are buckwheat pancakes. They taste awful unless you take the goose gravy and pour it on the pancakes. Then it tastes very good. And I had eaten a meal that I was just completely stuffed. There are 10 or 15 people over to my parents' house, my grandparents and parents' house, and they're in the living room about 10 feet away from the kitchen. I go to the kitchen to get a diet drink, which I've always loved the idea. I'm stuffed. And there's the goose carcass sitting on the cutting board, and the skin of the goose, which is so fat that the skin comes right off. It's not like turkey or chicken skin that actually sticks to the flesh. It just comes right off. The skin was sort of hanging over the carcass. And I said to myself, I really like the taste of goose skin. I'm too full to eat anything more, but I just have a taste. So I took this whole goose skin in my hands. And remember, 10 feet away, around the corner, is 10 or 15 people. And I try to, just grab a bit of it, just to have a little taste. But goose skin is very, very tough. So I keep putting a bit in to find the weak point. I blank out, at least my memory blanks out, until I find myself with the entire goose skin in my mouth. It is burning the inside of my mouth. Even an hour and a half after it's taken out of the oven, it's still boiling hot. It's burning inside my mouth. I'm chewing frantically because it's so hot. The fat is spurting out of my mouth. But am I giving it up? I am not. As a matter of fact, I chew so frantically that all the fat of the skin comes off. And I swallow that, other than the stuff that's dribbling down my chin. And I then swallow the skin. Well, that's what qualifies me, I think. Then here's another story that will help qualify you as well as me. I went to a small college in the States, in Minnesota, 40 miles south of Minneapolis. And there's a train that took me from Winnipeg, where I live, about 500 miles from Minneapolis, an overnight train. There used to be an overnight train back in the old days of the 60s. And it's spring. It's a dirty Minneapolis morning. I arrive about 6 in the morning. My bus leaves at 8 for the college. So I have about 2 hours to wander about. I've had the standard train breakfast, which consists of a cinnamon bun, you know, and tepid coffee. And so I'm wandering about on Hennepin Avenue, which, if you know Minneapolis, was at that time a skid row of types. So I'm wandering about there, and there's a diner. It's a 24-hour diner, 39 cents, you know, two toasts, two eggs, two hash browns, coffee, bacon, you know, all that, 39 cents. Why not? I walk in. It's full of smoke. It's full of people who have clearly been up all night. It's full of people who have had a really hard night, a hard night. And I squeeze, and it's full. And I squeeze myself into the counter. I have one little stool, and I get this breakfast. And it is greasy, and it's awful, but I'm eating it. Suddenly, the guy sitting right next to me vomits in his plate. And then he faints, and his face goes right into the vomit. And here's the test. What did I do? I kept on eating. Now, you'd fail that test if you were not a compulsive eater. Now, those are my stories on the one side. The stories that I will talk about later to illustrate, I won't talk about them again, but that illustrate what Dr. Silkworth, in the doctor's opinion, calls the allergy of the body. Here are my other stories. I lived for a while in Chicago, actually, and lived on very little money and lost weight. I was walking everywhere. I couldn't take transportation much, and I was living on very little, so I would buy skim milk powder and rice, and, you know, I was thin for the first time. I came back home into the wonderful overeating bosom of my family. My grandmother worried about me. You're thin, you're sick. You know, something wrong with you. But I was doing very well. But I said to myself, I deserve bananas and cream. This was a concoction I used to make, which consisted of you cut up a banana in a big bowl. You then fill it up to the brim with cream. Then you add as much sugar as will float over the top of the bananas. Then you quickly eat the bananas, and you end up with flavored sweet cream. I thought, I deserve it now. I'm thin. I can finally have this kind of stuff. I have money now. My mother and father and my grandparents have money. So I said, but I'm not just going to have cream. I'm going to have Devonshire cream. You know, this is the thick English cream that's 90% fat. You shake it comes in cans. You shake it turns into butter. And I got that cold. I prepared everything for this great moment. And I took a bite. And actually, it's a bite because the cream is so thick that you can't, it's like a sour cream. It's like sour cream. And I couldn't eat it. My body was fat was so foreign at that point. I was in 21. It was so foreign to me that it actually nauseated me to have that much fat in me. First time in my life that much fat had that effect on me. And my reaction? Well, it wasn't to say, thank God, you've been fat all your life, you're finally thin, you don't want this fat stuff. It was, wow, I'd better get into training. I started with 2%, I went to whole milk, I went to 10%, so I could have this again. And here's another, here are the generic versions. I'm standing up, so it doesn't count. She's not looking. I'm very depressed. I'm so depressed. I want to commit suicide, and this is a nice way of committing suicide. My days will be lessened, but no one will blame. My wife won't blame herself for my death. I'll just die of that. You should know that in my family, I have diabetes on 3 out of 4 of my grandparents, overeating throughout my family, heart disease, high blood pressure, and you know, I hope, that diabetes is a hidden killer, that it is responsible for so many deaths from some other cause, strokes, gangrene, blindness, all that kind of thing. So I'm depressed. I have suicide. No one loves me. On the other side, too many people love me. Right? I mean, no one loves me and too many people love me. I've had simultaneously. I'm very happy. How can I celebrate? I have the wrong page in this book. Because I have a good list. I can't always remember. Here's my favorite, one of my favorites. I'll never have this food again. The chef died just now without leaving the recipe. It's organic, whole grain with cold expressed organic oil. And molasses, not sugar. I have to taste it in order to see whether it's good. They made it especially for me. How can I refuse? I've been very good for a year. I've been very good for 6 months. I've been very good for a month. I've been very good for a week. I've been very good for a day. I've been very good for an hour. I didn't eat the bun at supper time. Now, excuses? Oh, yeah. And those are excuses that are designed to illustrate the mental obsession that the doctor talks about. Put very briefly, I have a dual problem. And you're going to hear words here which are different from the words that are normally used in this program. And I'm going to use these words because they're from the big book. I have a physical problem and a mental problem. Not an emotional, but mental. And when I say not an emotional, mental includes emotional, but emotional doesn't necessarily include mental. So I have a mental problem. And that the physical problem is that in some way, shape, or form, certain things create in me uncontrollable cravings that force me, despite my attempt to impose my will, force me to continue eating them. And I took me 7 years in this program to accept that fact. I could not accept that. I didn't want to accept it. I accepted what almost every diet has ever told me. And every nutritionist tell you and doctors tell you, you can eat anything you want in moderation. And some of the what used to be pretty good diet programs have been modified to the point that they let you eat. They reward you with your killer foods or something like that, 1 hour a week or something like that, or with point system or things of that sort. You can eat anything you want in moderation. So I suffer from that. I can't stop once I've started. I also suffer from a mental problem. And that is the obsession that somehow, someday, I will both control the quantities and enjoy, feel happy with the limited quantities I've controlled, my eating. And I give myself excuses, sometimes deeply emotional ones and sometimes simply stupid, to go back. So I can't stop from starting again. On the one hand, I can't stop once I've started. On the other hand, I can't stop from starting. I am in a vicious circle. I am therefore doomed. I got hope. That's step one. And I became abstinent. I'll talk about that. And then I got hope. I found people in Overeaters Anonymous who had worked the steps and didn't want to eat. Their mind was sane. They no longer had the excuses that sent them back to the food. That gave me hope. They said they did it by pursuing a spiritual path. Didn't care much for spiritual paths, but I wanted what they had. So I did what they did. What did they do? They worked the steps. I made a decision to work those steps. That was step three. And the steps that I worked, steps 4 through 9, brought me recovery. And then 10, 11, 12, I continued to work those steps to give me recovery, to maintain my recovery and my spiritual condition. That's my story in a nutshell. I can tell it short, I can tell it long, I'm now going to tell it long. I'd ask you to turn to the doctor's opinion. Oh, I want to make one distinction before we do that, and that is found in the foreword to the third edition, which is found on XXII. It talks there in the middle of the third paragraph, the 12 steps that summarize the program. And that means to me that the 12 steps that we recite at every meeting are simply a summary of a program that is set forth in greater detail in the big book itself. The big book forward to the second edition calls itself the basic text. And as Joe and Charlie point out, a textbook is a book in which people with information give it to someone who doesn't have it. And you start at the beginning and you read it to the end because it's carefully designed to provide you with that information. I misunderstood the steps because AA has a 12 and 12 and OA has a 12 and 12 and NA has a 12. We all have, they're all 12 and 12 in every 12-step program. Each one giving approximately the same number of pages to each step. We often think that each step deserves the same amount of time and energy. But as we'll see, and I may be able to show you sometime today, there were originally only 6 steps. And when Bill set out to write the steps, when he put them down into how it works, he decided to create more steps simply to plug any loopholes. The big book was designed for people who had no one from AA around them. The method that they had used for 4 years was talk and talk and talk, find a prospect, talk and talk and talk and talk and talk, sort of initiate them into this wonderful cult that we're all in, and get them to work the steps. But this was designed to be read by people who had no one from AA around them, and it's a do-it-yourself textbook for recovery without anyone from AA helping you. That's why one of my propositions is you don't need a sponsor. Sponsor is very helpful, but you don't need one. You can recover without one. So Bill decided he had to put in loopholes, plug the loopholes in the original 6 steps. I'll tell you what they were later on, but you have to plug the loopholes. And the 6 steps are the ones that you'll find have in this book a great deal of pages devoted to them, and the others have very little devoted to them. So we'll talk about that, and we'll talk about how we do steps 6 and 7 and 8 the same day you do step 5, which is a very revolutionary premise and one that bothers a lot of people. But we'll talk about it from the big book perspective. I'm not saying it's the only way, but I think you'll see from the big book perspective that is how it works. All right. The doctor's opinion. The doctor was Dr. William Silkworth. He was a doctor. He was a neurologist and psychologist who lost money and went to work for the Towns Hospital, which was a hospital that in New York in the 20s and 30s, maybe even later, catered to rich alcoholics and helped them dry out. And he tried deeply and heartfeltly. He was called the little doctor, the saint. He tried and ministered to thousands and tens of thousands of alcoholics during his tenure at the Towns Hospital. In 1932 or 33, he published a few papers providing a theory of alcoholism which was different from any theory up to that point. And that was that alcoholics had this dual problem. It was not a moral problem, that they just didn't have the will. It was that they had a physical problem, what he called an allergy. And an allergy does not mean what we think it means now. An allergy now means to us something that gives us a rash or hives or a cough, that we get a clear bad reaction to it. And I remember when I first studied this with the guy who, I haven't told you my history, but I first studied this I was studying with a guy with a grade 9 education. I have an MA in English, a BA in English and philosophy. I'm a lawyer. I know words, and I'm, you know, and I have the two greatest dictionaries in the English language in my office, and we were studying this thing. And I said to him, I don't have an allergy. He said, yes, you do. I said, no, I don't break out. I love food. I don't break out in rashes. I don't get any, you know, bad physical reactions from it. He said, look it up. And I looked it up. Well, allergy is a very young word. It was first used in the early 1900s. And it simply meant at that time, as it meant to Dr. Silkworth, an abnormal physical reaction to a physical substance. Well, that I have. Because what the doctor describes as the abnormal physical reaction is a craving, an uncontrollable craving, what he calls the phenomenon of craving. A phenomenon is simply an unexplained occurrence. It's something which we don't understand, or we don't know the cause of it, but we know it occurs. That's all a phenomenon is. And the plural phenomenon is phenomena. It comes from the Greek. So he called it the phenomenon of craving. He didn't know why it happened, but he knew that alcoholics got uncontrollable cravings when they drank so much as one drink of alcohol, different from normal people. And so my friend was right. My reaction, my abnormal reaction, was an uncontrollable craving, not with alcohol. I'll tell you, I've been in situations where I've had the greatest, I like wine and beer, I don't like hard liquor, but for reasons that are fascinating, but beyond the time I have to tell, I once had an opportunity to drink a $90 bottle of wine. It was different. It was better. I can tell you, it's better than the stuff I buy. And even when I splurge, it's better than the stuff I splurge on. And I took it in my mouth and I savored that. It was so good. And after three quarters of a wine glass, I couldn't have any more. My body was saying no more. That's it. As good as it tastes, I can't take any more. I've never had that with the foods that are my killer foods. So that's the allergy of the body. He also had this theory that the real problem didn't occur in the allergy of the body. People who get abnormal reactions to food don't eat that food. You know, my father's partner has a grandson who's celiac, and he cannot have gluten. Well, for years they didn't know that, and he just didn't want to eat, and they kept trying to give him food, and he didn't want to eat, because most of the food that they served him had gluten in it. And his body was regulating itself. It was saying, I can't take this stuff. If my wife, who's, as I say, is a chocoholic, were told she can't eat chocolate, she would mourn. I can tell you that. I know she'd mourn, but she wouldn't eat chocolate. Why would she eat anything that would have a danger for her? Anyone with who gets anaphylactic shock from peanuts or shrimp, who is sane, would say, well, I guess I just won't eat any peanuts or shrimp. Okay. So the insanity that the doctor describes is the insanity of a person who, knowing that he or she has a bad reaction to a certain substance, continues to indulge in it and has a mind that continues to encourage that person to indulge in it. That's the real problem. And Dr. Silkworth had no idea how to get rid of that. He would dry these people up. He would lecture to them about the allergy of the body and tell them, you just can't have it. You can't have so much as one drink. Just don't. Okay, doctor, I can't have one drink. And then they go to a bar and they drink and they come back to it. So that's what Silkworth described. It's the alcoholic's dilemma. On the one hand, you can't stop once you started. And on the other hand, you cannot stop from starting. So that's what Dr. Silkworth's opinion is. And he provides that in the preparatory sections of the big book. Just to read one part, and this depends on whether you have the third or the fourth edition. In the fourth edition, it's on page XXVI, and in the third edition, it's just two pages earlier, XXIV. When Dr. Silkworth, the big book people summarized this in the larger font, the physician who at our request gave us this letter has been kind enough to enlarge upon his views in another statement which follows. In this statement, he confirms that we who have suffered alcoholic torture must believe. There are musts in the big book. It's not as if, you know, if you want, if half measures avail you nothing. I think Don said yesterday half measures avail you less than nothing. 11/12 measures avail you less than nothing, too. There are musts. The program is suggested, not parts of the program. It's either the program or not. We must believe. What must we believe? That the body of the alcoholic is quite as abnormal as his mind. It did not satisfy us to be told that we could not control our drinking just because we were maladjusted to life, that we were in full fight for reality, or were outright mental defectives. These things were true to some extent, in fact, to a considerable extent with some of us. But we are sure that our bodies were sickened as well. In our belief, any picture of the alcoholic which leaves out this physical factor is incomplete. And I left it out for 7 years. I made two mistakes. I have a history of relapse, first 6 or 7 years of the program. One reason for my relapses was this. As soon as I lost the weight, as soon as I felt great, as soon as I worked the steps and felt great and everything was terrific, I said, now I can have a scoop of ice cream a week, as my previous diet plan had allowed me to have. Or two cookies, or a half a donut, as I recall. And, it began to be just a bit bigger. It began to be giant donuts, the scoop got bigger, you know, until I was back at the tub of ice cream. Okay. Now, the big book goes on. The doctor's theory that we have an allergy to alcohol interests us. I've explained allergy. As laymen, our opinion as to the soundness, is soundness may, of course, mean little. But as ex-problem drinkers, we can say that his explanation makes good sense. It explains many things for which we cannot otherwise account. Four good reasons for believing in this allergy of the body. One is it should get rid of guilt. However you got to this point, it's your body that is a problem, and if you are a sane human being, you accept your disability. I wear glasses. I don't pretend I don't need glasses. You know? I have a body that will never run a four-minute mile, whether I'm thinner than I am or anything. It will never. I accept that as a disability or as a limitation, put it another way. A sane human being accepts a disability. Second, it tells us that if we are ever to get recovery, we cannot indulge in the things that create these problems. We have to abstain. Third, for the overeater, compulsive eater, not overeater, but compulsive eater, we have to figure out what to abstain from. Unlike the alcoholic who knows no alcohol in any form, we have to figure out for ourselves as individuals what our particular eating problem is. And that puts upon us a tremendous responsibility that is different and I think harder in many respects than most other 12-step programs have. Most others. Some are similar, but most others. And by the way, you know, alcoholics have it easier. They don't have to drink, but we have to eat. That's baloney. They do have to drink. They just can't drink alcohol. And I have to eat, but I don't have to eat the foods that I know are my trigger foods. And it's the same thing. And the fourth for compulsive eaters, the fourth reason why it's good to think of this allergy of the body is because most of us, many of us are people pleasers. And so we now know what to say to people who offer us food. No, thank you. I just discovered I have an allergy to it. And now we're free. Who wants to give you something you're allergic to? If they ask you, well, what's your symptoms? I'll give you three. The one I choose to give because step 12 is important for me. I want to carry the message as much as possible is, I clear the room with my boring qualities, but, I have an allergy to the body, which means that I can't eat certain foods, because if I do, I start to eat them again. I'm a member of Overeaters Anonymous, and if you know anyone who has an eating problem, and all that. So I clear the room sometimes. The second one is, I break out in fat, which is not a bad one. And the third is my bum begins to swell, which isn't bad. I just want to read parts of the doctor's opinion. I don't have time to read the whole thing. But he talks in the doctor's opinion in this chapter very much about this phenomenon, he calls it, of craving. And he says it's the only thing that alcoholics have in common with each other. Some of them may have tremendous mental problems. They may be so completely different mentally. They may be very sane, normal. They may be normal people. They may be manic depressive, he says, which is good for a whole chapter in itself. There's the ones who are in denial, the ones who keep trying. They have only one symptom, he says, in common. And that's found on page XXX in the fourth edition and XXVIII in the third edition. In the second last paragraph there. And this is a paragraph that has extreme importance for OA. All these and many others have one symptom in common. They cannot start drinking without developing the phenomenon of craving, the unexplained occurrence of craving. This phenomenon, as we have suggested, may be the manifestation, the symptom of an allergy which differentiates these people, which sets them apart as a distinct entity. It has never been, by any treatment with which we are familiar, permanently eradicated. The only relief we have to suggest is entire abstinence. Roseanne, our co-founder, tells a story of being in an open AA meeting and hearing this paragraph read. And this is in 1961 or 62, when OA was a fledgling organization, and a whole bunch of diet plans were being used by a whole bunch of people to get abstinent. But they didn't have the concept. They were just using diet plans. And she suddenly realized, after hearing this paragraph read, that abstinence is what we have to use. It's our sobriety. It's the best word to use to describe the equivalent of sobriety in AA. She sent out a letter to all the groups, not all of which appreciated this letter, but she said, we must abstain from compulsive eating. And that means that we must not eat between meals, and because people were following this program, and I used to follow it, where you'd eat between meals non-caloric things or low-calorie things to keep your mouth busy so you wouldn't think about eating. But that meant I was compulsively eating all the time, even though it wasn't adding weight to me, it was compulsive eating. So she sent this out. That was the beginning of the well-known 301, three meals a day, nothing in between, a day at a time. So this paragraph has tremendous resonance within OA, and I want to use this paragraph as a segue onto the notion of finding your own sense of what it is that you have to abstain from. And here I'm going to be a little contentious, because I do believe that there are a bunch of ideas that people in OA have which they adopt from others, and they just take on a plan that works for others, and they don't really think about whether it works for themselves, whether it's right for themselves. I do want to say that on pages 2 and 3 of our OA 12 and 12, there is a description not only of food problems but eating behaviors. They say, clearly, if we are to live free of the bondage of compulsive eating, we must abstain from all foods and eating behaviors which cause us problems. And when I think about an eating behavior in relation to the allergy of the body, I think of an eating behavior which is so ingrained in me that it's impossible for me to stop once I start. Regardless of whether I'd have, maybe 30 years of psychoanalysis would do it for me, but it's physical in the sense that I can't stop in the same way I can't stop blinking. I can stop for 30 seconds, but I can't keep myself from blinking. I can't keep my heart from beating. I can't keep my breath. I can't keep myself from breathing. So it's physical in the sense that I can't get rid of this eating behavior unless I abstain from it completely. How do we develop a sense of abstaining? Well, I'll tell you what I do with my sponsees. I'll tell you what I did with myself. I figured out what my binge foods are first. What are the foods that once I started, I couldn't stop? And I hasten to say, not all the time. Are there some foods that at times I haven't been able to stop once I started? I made the list, and it was a pretty simple list. I knew those foods, shortbread, ice cream, cheesecake, goose fat, any fried foods, deep fried foods of any kind. Popcorn. I joke, but it's true. I put popcorn on my butter. Buttered popcorn, a few other things. And I obviously had to eliminate those, because once I started those, I couldn't stop. I also began to do an analysis of those. Did they have any ingredients in common? And it became clear to me that my real difficulties lay in a combination of fat and sugar and fat and salt. It was high-fat products in combination with others, with sugar or with fat. And I want to emphasize that because we hear very often in this program, and I don't doubt that this is true for many people, that people have a, you know, I'm sugar-free or I'm carbohydrate-free or I'm, you know, white flour-free. And I think back to a conversation I had with a person who because I also talk about the responsibility, and it's now reflected in our definition of abstinence, of maintaining a healthy, a normal body weight, a healthy body weight, striving to and maintaining a healthy body weight. I think we have that responsibility as compulsive eaters, as recovered compulsive eaters, because how else are we attractive to those who still suffer? And I hasten to say, I mean, I joked about it at the beginning of this thing, I am not a poster boy. I'm healthy. My doctor is happy with my weight. That's one of my conditions for knowing whether I'm doing well in this program. But I certainly am not, you know, I am not a god. And you would not want to see me in a bathing suit. Certainly wouldn't want to see you without one either. Where was I? stuck with that image. Yeah, believe me, it's a terrible image. Sorry about that. Let's go on to something else. So I was talking to a person who said, I've been abstinent for 11 years and I haven't lost any weight. I said, well, we've been abstinent from sugar. Haven't had sugar for 11 years. I said, okay, I'm going to try a test on you. Imagine that I have a pound of sugar in front of me, a bag of sugar, and I have a tablespoon, and I forced you to eat 4 tablespoons of sugar. Would you want to finish that pound? Would your body tell you, I got to finish that pound? I've met people who say yes, but I've met few people who say yes. Most people would say, as she said, no, I couldn't eat that. And even in my worst times, I wouldn't eat the whole pound of sugar. I said, well, so maybe sugar in itself isn't a problem. Name me one of your binge foods. Donuts, she said. I said, well, there is another ingredient in donuts. She said, white flour. That's my problem. I eat white flour. I said, okay, let me put a pound of white flour in front of you. Let me take that tablespoon and force you to eat 4 tablespoons of flour. Would you want to eat the rest of it? She said, I can't even imagine eating the flour. I said, well, maybe white flour isn't your problem. There is another ingredient, I said, to donuts. And she said, what's that? I said, the fat. It's deep fried fat. Donuts are deep fried fat. There's a lot of fat in them, and then you deep fry them. And her response was to walk away. Now, I've met a lot of people in this program who have been abstinent in many, many ways, who are still have not yet achieved a healthy body weight. And I really like to challenge them to think about whether or not their abstinence from sugar, which obviously is a major ingredient in one of the tremendous binge foods so many of us have, pastries and desserts, you know, eliminating sugar is all that has to be done. If you're compensating for that by putting butter on your mashed potato, and you don't eat flour, so you won't eat any bread, but you'll eat a potato and you'll put onto it a pound of butter. Well, not a pound, but, you know, sour cream and butter and bacon bits. Whether you're eating other kinds of food, not you in particular, but I think it's important to challenge. I challenge sponsees with this. You eliminate pastries, you eliminate desserts, but you haven't eliminated all the fats that you eat at other times. And there is some research on fat, and the fast food places know that you put a lot of fat in stuff with salt, and people seem to love it, some people seem to get addicted. But I'm not here to tell you that that's your problem. That's my problem. I cannot eat foods high in fat content. I can't eat dairy fats at all. I have real problems with dairy fats. And so I do not have anything made with cream or butter, and I avoid all foods that are high in dairy fats. I also avoid all foods. I avoid deep-fried foods. I avoid foods that are high in fat content. I look at the fat content in the nutrition labeling, and I have a certain limit to the amount of fat that I can have in a meal. That's one thing I do.